SoFi, the all-in-one super app for banking, borrowing, and investing. Earn industry-leading APY, get great loan rates, and trade stocks. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC.
One PM on the East Coast, Swizzle here, joined by and she starts to laugh. We're joined by Elizabeth Young of SoFi.
EY from SoFi.
I coined that.
Yeah, you did.
And Dan Nathan of Risk Reversal Media.
Yeah.
Today is Wednesday. Rangers played last night. You were at the game.
Amazing game. Just give me your 2 cents there. You're sitting at home. Your guy.
Well, it's one of those games, you know, you're playing the Flyers. The Flyers are playing for their playoff lives.
Yes, they were.
So they came out skating without question. Rangers were dead in the first. I get it. I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
Over the course of an 82-game schedule, you're going to have some clunkers. But you know what? They came back. They got their skating legs underneath them. Scored a couple goals in the second. Igor let up a couple soft ones, but some of those goals were he was not going to stop those pucks. But the Rangers emerged victorious, first team to 100 points in NHL. Artemi Panarin, first Ranger, I think, in 17 years to score 100 points in a season. Amazing.
It was 6-5, Liz, in overtime, and the Rangers won like 10 seconds in.
Adam Fox just
amazing.
You know, Adam
Fox. Two overtime games in a row.
Yes,
but that's not why the folks are here.
What folks?
The folks that are out there. Oh, all right.
Sorry about that. You got me started.
It's kind of the sort of market.
Sorry,
Amanda's it's the sort of market right now where it makes you want to talk about your New York Rangers. It might make you want to talk about your Milwaukee Brewers that are, you know what I mean, down
well, not
south.
Quite yet, but
no, but what I'm saying is it's like there's not a lot going on right now.
Well, if you're long stocks, you're feeling pretty good.
I know, but it's a lot of yesterday we were talking about up either side of 20 bips on the NASDAQ or the S&P. Today we're at the same thing. I think it is interesting today that we saw this reversal yesterday in NVIDIA. We see it lower today, but you know what is up? Apple and Tesla. So
makes
we keep
sense.
Seeing this kind of crisscross apple sauce sort of thing, the bifurcation in the Mag 7. You know what I mean? Those
Dan's
were
a
source of fun.
Free time.
I was a camp counselor.
Were you? Yeah.
Crisscross applesauce. What is if somebody said it to me, I'd effing lay him out.
I literally just said it to you.
Yeah,
so
but
are we
you
fighting?
Know, no, we're not. But if I was younger, like the younger me would not have done well
not
with something
taken
like
too
that.
Kindly to that. All right.
But I wasn't a camp person.
But
we
again,
didn't have money to go to camp.
Picture Dan
so
camp
so people
counselor.
Keep talking about this broadening out, Liz. Okay. And it's interesting, you know, and I've made this case on many occasions. You know, the banks are not enough. The energy's not enough, you know, without tech, you know what I mean? But we're seeing a bifurcation in tech, but we're seeing a lot of green. Like a day like today, we're seeing banks. We're gonna hit that. Should we hit the rundown here?
Let's go to the rundown. Do we do it behind us or we do I put my finger up and there it was.
Ta-da!
Record year for record highs. I like that. This is so Amanda Diaz, by the way. Elizabeth looks at currency volatility and it's happening. Nobody wants to talk about it. Elizabeth is smart to point it out. By the bank breakout. That's Dan Nathan, by the way.
We're gonna do a little trade in one of the banks.
So stick around for that.
An options trade.
And if it's Wednesday, it's an audience Q&A day.
Yeah.
And I always like that. We get so actually, you know, we've been doing that often, but we like doing it when EY is here. So there you go.
Yeah. All right. Let's do this. Record year for record highs, Liz. This is some data that you also have been tracking. You've been talking about the record amount of time that we haven't had a 2% down day in the S&P 500. But this is, I think, from Charlie Bolello here. We've already seen 20 all-time highs this year, still on pace to exceed the record from 1995, which is pretty fascinating. A lot of folks go back to 1995 and they say, you know, that is the period that caused Fed Chair, who was it back then? Greenspan.
Sure.
To utter the words, irrational exuberance. But yet the S&P, Liz, rallied on average 30% a year for the next 4 years after he uttered those words.
I was
going
to say 3.5 years, but it was a remarkable run.
Talk to us. Yeah. What do you see when you see
well,
this?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I think if I had to distill it down into one sentence, ride it until it's done. You can take advantage of it while it's happening. It doesn't mean that it's going to make sense or that it's going to feel rational. I'm looking at this chart. Wall Street's 2024 year-end price targets versus current level. There is one price target that has not been blown out, and it's, I think it says Yardeni. Is that who it is? Yardeni Research?
Yeah.
And Ed usually skews bullish. So maybe not surprising that he's the only one that's above the current level. I'm willing to bet that we see some of these ones below move up again. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that have already increased their price targets, I bet we see more of them move and continue to chase. But that's just the feeling in the market right now. Now, is it smart to chase the stuff that's been driving this the entire way? Probably not. So that's where the rotation trade comes from. The biggest question is, are people rotating because the fundamentals actually support that rotation? Or are they just rotating because they don't know what else to do? They don't know where else to put their money. If you look at the factor trades and the things that have actually been driving the market and break it down into different pieces, what drove us from October to December was, I think you usually call this the, what, dash for trash, yeah, or something like uh-huh. that. So it was beta, it was momentum, yeah. It wasn't high quality stuff. It was large cap. But then you get into 2024, it switches to some more high quality, still beta in there, definitely still large cap. But now in March, you've got value outperforming, you've got dividends, things that just different factors that people are looking at. I think that yes, economic fundamentals are supportive of that, but I think it's more people just looking around for what else can I buy?
We're going to look at the S&P chart, but IWM, I look at the IWM, you could look at a number of different indices that measure the small caps, but you know, here at 208 or so, I mean, if I'm being truthful and honest, I'll say, you know what, that 206 and a half, 207 level, something we've pointed out a number of different times, seemingly are through it now. So to your point about rotation, Elizabeth, this seems to be where people are sort of focused on, maybe correctly so, I don't know, but with yields being somewhat benign-ish, yeah, maybe small caps do make sense.
Well, they're not rotating that much, though,
no,
if you think about it. I mean, like, if you think about just what it would take to move the Russell 2000 around, it is the size of Microsoft, right? And so, again, if you want to break this thing out, like, you would, it wouldn't take a whole heck of a lot of new capital there, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. that's one of the areas, one of the reasons why I think we're going to touch on banks a little bit, just because, you know, the runaway breakout in some of these names, JP Morgan, obviously the largest name in the sector. I mean, I think that is dragging a lot of other stuff. So maybe they can pull up Deutsche Bank for a second here, Guy. We talked about this on Market Call, I think about 2 weeks ago when it mm-hmm. broke out here. Look at this one. Okay, this is not a name that we talk a whole, look at it, it just keeps gapping. You know what I mean? It had that consolidation after the gap to new highs. So again, that speaks to me about rotation. Look, Russell is not saying rotation to me yet.
Fair enough. Real quick, and you're right to point out Deutsche Bank, but for context, if we could put up like a 20-year Deutsche Bank chart, yeah, you know, you'll see something that, yeah, I mean, it looks great in the context of that time horizon, but if you look at this thing over a period of time.
That looks great.
Well, let's even go back even longer term if you want. I mean, you'll see. I mean, this stock has been mired. Now, you could say Carter might say, this is a bearish to bullish reversal. My only point is, I mean, this thing has been in no man's land for a while, but you're right to point it out.
That is the dash for trash. That is what you go for at this stage of the game. And why did we spend a lot of time yesterday talking about some of these IPOs and scarcity and the like? And so to me, like, if I'm sitting in my old long short equity, you know, trading seat, no matter where the hell I am, I'm looking for things like that. I'm looking for things that actually could double if the S&P were to go up another 10%. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing that me, you know, Liz, so I don't know. Yeah. Thoughts there on the
Well, so here's the thing. When people start to rotate into stuff that doesn't really make sense, or maybe there's no good reason for it, then you start to see some of the signals trigger, and Carter would be a great source for this, but some of the signals that we haven't seen hit yet. So things like the entire index looking overbought, or a certain amount of stocks being above their 200-day moving average. We're not at extreme levels of that yet. So we need more of a dash for trash to bring all of those stocks up to the point where then everybody looks at it and it's almost unequivocally, we can't buy any, we can't convince ourselves to buy anymore. There's nothing left.
You just said something really interesting. So Guy, we had Urien Timmer last night on CNBC's Fast Money. He is the head market strategist over there at Fidelity, kind of a big shop there when it comes to the equity markets. You know, it was interesting. He used the term, or he used the expression, he just said like X percent, I can't remember what the number was, of S&P stocks above their 200. He was basically suggesting that's a very bullish thing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't getting to what Liz is saying, the sort of readings that would say, well, it's it's X percent over their 200-day, which is making you a little nervous. Now, David Rosenberg of Rosenberg Research, a good friend of the pod, he's actually coming on the tape podcast with us, guy. We sit down with him tomorrow. It's going to drop on Friday in your favorite podcast store. But he was talking about in one of his notes earlier this week, the percentage, I guess the S&P is about 14% above its 200-day. So let's focus on that. Let's pull up the S&P chart,
and you can see it firsthand where we are. I mean, the 200-day moving average probably comes in around 4,600 or so-ish.
Yep.
Right here we are sitting.
It's kind of that breakout level, too.
Exactly. Here we are sitting, you know, 5,200 and change. So you can do that math, and he is right to point it out. You know, my concern, again, unfounded for quite some time, is the longer we stay sort of these 2.5-3 standard deviations away, the more likely we are to view it at some point and go and visit it at some point. And you do have these mean reversions throughout history. We just haven't seen one, basically, I want to say, Dan, since what, October of last year or so? So, you know, a few months into this year, and here we are, seemingly every day moving higher and higher and farther away from that moving average. Look, moving average is great. I mean, it's starting to move to the upside. It's all, but the mean reversion, Dan, is what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, and I guess the point, you know, the S&P sold off 11% from its July 2023 highs to its late October lows. We've since been up about 27% in the high, at the highs in July. I think we're about 12 or so percent above that 200-day moving average. One of the reasons we wanted just to focus a little bit on the S&P 500 here, again, we know the top, the concentration of those top 10 names, about 30% or so. But Liz, you know, this is where the macro comes into play. And there's been a lot of talk. Guy's been talking about it. You both were talking about it on the Monday on the tape podcast. We're talking about this level in the dollar yen. Okay. And we're talking about what's going on there. And you're spending some time in your note that drops tomorrow on the SoFi investing blog a little bit. Break it down what you're looking at. A guy has been highlighting it here. We want to just kind of give a sense to the listener, the viewer here, what it actually means and what it could mean, let's say, for the US stock market, the S&P 500 in particular.
Yep. I just want to close the loop on some of the metrics that I mentioned real quick on the S&P. So things that you can watch, percent of stocks at a 52-week high. Usually you see that peak before the market peaks. Right now, we're still only at about 25% of stocks that are at a 52-week high, so not sending many signals. You want to see that up closer to 50% before you start to get concerned. And then you see usually the number of stocks above their 200-day actually start to break down before the market breaks down. That has not been happening. We're still seeing that expand. So that's where we see no alarm bells as of yet, not incredibly overbought. Okay, so dollar yen, or just yen in general. Yeah. When I used alliteration. Mm. You know what alliteration is?
Yes, I do.
As the theme for this week. Current currency conundrum is the name of the column. And then there are other sections, volatility vacuum, all fun stuff, right? I have a lot of fun doing this kind of crap. So here's what happened. We started talking about the yen a lot in the last month or so. And I think there's probably a lot of investors out there wondering why. Why does it matter? We know that the Bank of Japan exited negative rate policy for the first time since 2016. It's actually the first rate hike that they've done, I believe, since 2007. So it's been a very, very long time since they've done this. I think many people expected that if and when they finally did exit negative interest rate policy, that something would happen. And nothing really did. Why not? Well, first of all, because they move rates by 10 bips at a time, not 25 bips. Mm-hmm. So it's much smaller increments. Second of all, because they've held rates so low for so long that the yen was already pretty depressed and people didn't really want it. And then you have to look at what's called the interest rate differential. So Japan raises their 10-year yield. It's what, nominally at 0.7 or something. The interest rate differential to the US makes the dollar and treasury still look a heck of a lot more attractive. So the yen actually weakened. Now, Guy, I know you have some thoughts on the threat of yen weakening. The thing that I focused on in this column is a lot about the carry trade and the fear over actually the yen strengthening, which has not happened yet. It could. And I believe that there is probably a level, we don't know where. Mario and I tried to figure out exactly where would be that particular level. We're guessing somewhere in the low 140s, if it strengthened to the low 140s, where the carry trade and covering the carry trade starts to buying begets buying of the yen. And then you've got what would almost look like a short covering rally in the yen. But I don't know what that exact level is.
So it's interesting. The carry trade is one portion of this without question. So the risk on trade, I get all those things. And you're right to point them out. The flip side of that coin is one has to want. So listen, for their exporters, for their companies, this is actually a wonderful thing, right? It makes their goods far more attractive. However, for the folks at home, for their citizens, this is no bueno. And I think they're dealing with that. And I'm not suggesting we're on the verge of a currency crisis, but you're seeing sort of around the edges, people starting to talk about this. Now, what's going to happen? At some point, the Bank of Japan is going to have to come in and defend their currency. They've done it before, which is fine. What do they have to do to defend that currency? Well, I think today the Japanese are still the largest holders of U.S. Treasuries. So in order to defend their currency, they're going to have to sell something to do that. So this starts to become this circle or cycle of selling U.S. Treasuries, buying the yen against the dollar, and hoping that that will work. And to the extent that it does, you could say, okay, that's it. But if it starts to not work, and if you start to see the market calling bullshit, that cycle continues. So my concern amongst many are this could be another factor that drives up U.S. interest rates. Now, you're obviously not seeing it today, but stick around, folks. Stay tuned because it's coming to a theater near you.
Right. And just to bring it back to the stock market again, so if this has been a very popular trade for decades now, so it's selling yen, taking the proceeds, and buy our higher yielding sort of things, which include U.S. stocks, right? So it's been a big funding instrument of cash coming into that market. You unwind that and you could have the exact opposite. And again, like that's one of the reasons why I saw somebody, and again, I try to stay as off Twitter as much as possible. But I like to see what's trending. You know what I mean? And it seems like every day CNBC.
How do you
trending.
Do that?
So there's a little box. It's like a search box. It shows like on the right, it shows like what's trending, topics, trending. Hashtags, that sort of thing. CNBC is always trending.
Good feature.
Every time I see that, I always like click on it and say, please don't be in there. Please don't be in there. That sort of thing.
Please what? You not be
in there? I'm just saying, I said something stupid about Fast Money. You know, I'm kidding. But you don't even, usually it's a couple people, you know who they are. And so I guess my point is like one of the tweets that I saw in the CNBC trending was that, okay, well, this morning, you know, Squawk and Friends had three people on calling for a 5-10% drop in the stock market.
Ah.
Let's pull back that S&P chart again. All right. So, Guy, if we're at 5,200, what would be 10% of that?
10% of 5,200 would be 520 points.
Yeah. Okay.
And then so that's 15% would be 520 plus 260,
right. So basically,
which would be 780. I can do this all day long.
10% gets us to 4,700.
There
right?
you go.
It's almost exactly right. And so you see that rising 200-day moving average that's basically right above that breakout level. I wouldn't expect it if there was no reason other than some macro dislocation or something, you know what I mean? Some profit taking, and then maybe there's some semiconductor that disappoints on something or this and whatever. You get something that people can't see it happening right now. Look what happened last July into last October. Now, that's set up for an amazing rally. And Guy, you said it yesterday on Market Call. It's probably the best thing that could happen for intermediate to longer term bulls is to put a little fear back in the market, Liz.
You know what I think actually is more likely to happen is, yes, we do probably have a correction. If for nothing else, then everybody keeps talking about it and trying to beat each other to the punch, and then it just corrects a little bit. I would be surprised, absent other bad news, that it would get beyond even like 8%. But let's say it gets down there. Then I bet what happens is long-term bulls watch it bounce off of or bounce above that 200-day moving average and then raise their price targets. So let's say you're at 5,000, it gets down to 4,700. I bet we see people raise price targets there and go full-on bullish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, we got that out of the way. That cleared the way for more upside, another leg up.
You have a slide that speaks to the volatility in the global FX market, and I'd like you to bring that forth because, you know, again, we're talking about dollar yen, but there are other things moving as well. So let's take a look at that.
Yeah. So much like the VIX, there is a global FX VIX, and you're looking at it right now. This actually ends up being kind of a head scratcher. You look at this index, and this is all of the global currencies, EM and DM, versus the dollar. Now, what I just said about the yen, and everybody's heard about the yen and all of the things that have been going on in Japan, you would expect that this volatility index would be higher. The yen is 24% of this index, yet we're watching it move in a steady stream lower, and it's actually in the third percentile of volatility right now. So volatility is low. Here's the weird part. We talk about volatility as if it's synonymous with downside. So if the yen is weakening, people must think that there's got to be volatility. Well, it's been weakening pretty steadily for a while. Anything that's steady is not volatile. So it's not going to read as volatility globally. But this is something where you obviously see spikes in this, much like you see spikes in the VIX index. If we are at or near all-time lows in volatility, that would tell me that we're actually pulling that rubber band back tighter and tighter and tighter just to let it pop and watch volatility spike back up. I don't know what the cause of that is going to be. That could be anything, right? That could be something that really affects regions that produce a lot of oil. That causes a ton of currency volatility. It could be something that we absolutely do not see coming. But this right now looks like very, very calm waters. And I think it is for the moment. But I think that this is just before it becomes not calm waters.
Yeah, and bring it back to markets. Also, this is from Doug Cass, our friend over there at Seabreeze, who writes at Real Money. And I think this is really interesting. This is a topic that you've written about, you've talked about on Market Call, Liz. He's talking about equity risk premiums. One of the more accurate expressions of predictors of future market returns continue to be paper thin and expressed yesterday. The global equity risk premium is now at its lowest levels since 2008. And so again, when you overlay that with, let's say you're just using that FX volatility as an example, one thing that could cause some things to go haywire. When you think about equity risk premiums, where they are relative to history, how narrow they are, it doesn't make for a great set of forward returns without some sort of correction, without some sort of fear put in the market. Okay, one area that is, you know, kind of really bucking the trend. If you look at the outperformance, and we just mentioned this a few minutes ago, JP Morgan, you know, this stock is up more than 40% off its October lows. It makes new all-time highs seemingly every day. Mm-hmm. If you look at, let's just throw up the BKX here for a second here. It's interestingly, you know, that's a multi-year chart there. Okay. So we've basically broken that downtrend that's been in place from the highs in 2021. We've gotten back to those levels. You see that straight line down guy about a year ago from when it kind of that second point in that downtrend, that was the SVB crisis. The fact that we've been able to consolidate over the last few months or so, and now we've kind of broken out a little bit, that's interesting to me. Now let's throw the KRE up there. We've talked about the regional banks. You can see that on a relative basis, they performed far worse or so. Guy, you know, we're getting the quarter end. We know that the large money center banks are all going to be the first to report. I think it's Wells, Citi, and JP Morgan on April 12th. It's coming in hot. You just called the rate environment benign.
It is.
We had this kind of banking crisis that was kind of getting all geared up. We had just seen a 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, what, you know, on its way to 5% or so, right? 4 to 5% when a lot of this stuff was going on. Look at the KRE right now. It's kind of going sideways. That's not a bad consolidation. It's a consolidation well below its 52-week highs, which is not particularly bullish, especially when you look at the BKX. Thoughts on banks here, because there's one bank in particular now with M&A and IPOs coming back that I want to take a focus on. It's not exactly a money center, but they do have some exposure.
In the absence of bad news, banks have done well. Even with bad news, the larger banks have done well for, I think, the reasons being that, you know, they're the ones that actually went to all of the bad news with the small and regional banks. That all makes sense. And the charts you looked at are spot on. XLF, which I don't think is a particularly well-constructed ETF, it's 13% or something, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan 10%, then you have Visa and MasterCard sort of rounding it out. But if you look at a longer term chart of the XLF, you'll see that, you know what, we're trading right up to those prior highs that we saw in January of 2022. So depending on what ETF or indices you want to look at, it's going to tell a much different story. With all that said, the big banks get bigger. They're rewarding the JP Morgans. They've been rewarding the Goldman Sachs of the world to a certain extent. One has to wonder, though, is this the right environment to rewarding these stocks?
I think for some financials, it is an okay environment to be rewarded in. I would not be buying the index broadly right now. And we've talked about small cap a little bit. One of the things that you have to watch in the small cap index, I would break it out to small cap value, keeping in mind that the reason we talk about that is because over 20% of the small cap value index is financials. So if there is some kind of cyclical expansion that's happening that's going to be positive for financials and that's going to pull the regional banks out of whatever the rolling crisis is that they're in, you want to see that participate. And the year-to-date total return in financials in the small cap value index is negative 5.3%. So not going great. And you're not getting that confirmation yet that the risks we know of are solved. So I think there are certain banks that probably will benefit, much like what happened during the regional banking crisis. And perhaps some of the ones that we've talked about will be them. They're also benefiting from a reignition in capital markets activity, and that's okay. But I think much of the benefit that they saw in consolidation in the industry has already been had. Mm-hmm. And the cyclical expansion that we're talking about, some of the bullishness that's come out of econ data is more, it's tangible expansion. It's manufacturing expansion. It's onshoring. You know, it's not financials expansion. It's it's the stuff that we can touch and feel.
Well, listen, again, as we get into next week, we're going to start getting focused on Q1 earnings. We're going to start getting a sense for the sort of the sectors that are going to drive, let's say, you know, listen, if the guidance doesn't come in for some of the largest weighted, and we know what it is, it's technology, it's communication services and like here, that's going to be something that could be the reason to cause, you know, whatever sort of pullback that a lot of folks think could happen here. But, you know, one area that I would expect to continue to gain some steam, especially in a benign rate environment, especially with GDP prints coming in better than expected, especially in an economy that's dealing with higher levels of the of rates, you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing with inflation, even though it's picking up a little bit, it would be like some of these banks. I mean, like, you know, and I'm not coming to them right now, but specifically an investment bank like Morgan Stanley. Last week, we talked about that breakout guy in Goldman Sachs after that long consolidation. Let's just pull up this chart that I have of Morgan Stanley. I think this is interesting. Flat on the year. Now, you can look at that however you want, that move from last year. It looks a little bit like a head and shoulders bottom to me. You see that resistance level we're currently in. It's about 92.5 to 95. Let's pull it out to a five-year chart. Look at the downtrend that's been in place since late 2021, early 2022. We just picked our head up a little bit above that, which is interesting to me. Okay. So when I think about their exposures, I think about the fact they have a new CEO. I get it. He might kitchen sink some stuff when he does this call, you know what I mean, in the next couple of weeks or so. But I look at options prices and I say to myself, implied volatility, the price of options in Morgan Stanley look relatively cheap to me here. And they're only going to kind of start to move up as we get closer to earnings. But for those people who want to kind of play for a catch up in some of these names that have not been participating as much, Morgan Stanley could be a very interesting name to me for a whole host of fundamental reasons. Obviously, the technical ones make some sense to me. But if I want to do what Guy does every so often called buying the breakout, right, Guy? You want to set yourself up when it gets to a level to get long there. Using options to do that could make some sense. So here's a trade. I'm not exactly going to do this today, but I wanted to detail this because it's on my mind and I was looking at it. And I might want to do it closer to earnings. But today, the stock was just below $93, okay, unchanged on the year. Look out to May expiration. That's going to catch, obviously, this earnings event here. And I can look to buy the 95-105 call spread. That's a $10 wide. I'm buying one of the May 95 calls. Let's call it about 230, selling one of the May 105 calls at about 30 cents. Not a whole heck of a lot of premium here, but you see what I'm doing. It's a $10 wide. I'm paying $2, risking two to possibly make eight, okay, if the stock is up at 105 or higher on May expiration. I have more than a month and a half to do that and that earnings event. So to me, this trade idea makes some sense. The risk reward makes some sense. If I'm risking two, okay, you can do the math on a nine, you know, that's less than what, 2.5% of the stock price. When we're doing long premium directional trades using options, we're often using a mental stop, about 50% of the premium. So I'd look to cut this if it got to like $1, if the stock just went sideways or lower, that sort of thing. So I like the risk reward here. Guy, thoughts on the trade structures, thoughts on the name?
Structure's right. I mean, they report, I think, on April 16th before the bell. They probably have, I don't know, 13, 14% EPS growth trading, I don't know, not at a ridiculous valuation, probably trading at 11, 12. So you can make an argument on valuation. This stock is cheap. You could say that for a lot of these different banks, quite frankly. But in terms of where it is and where like a Goldman Sachs is, for example, I mean, Goldman Sachs is flirting with its all-time high. And I still think there's some room here for Morgan Stanley, which is all-time high is probably a little bit north of 100. So you're encompassing the right, I think, duration for sure. And I think in terms of the risk reward, you know, it sets up pretty well. And all these banks seemingly breaking out. Morgan Stanley's probably the next in the line.
Liz, thoughts on investment banks versus money centers? And we get it. If the money center banks, when the yields were just kind of moving higher and higher last year, right? The issue was their net interest margins and the exposures and kind of like their, you know, mark-to-market, you know what I mean, portfolios and the like here. Thoughts where you'd want to be positioned. Again, I mentioned, you know, IPOs are coming back a little bit and who knows? I mean, if the markets kind of get a little dicey, they're going to go away really quickly. There's been plenty of M&A. Thoughts on that? Investment banking versus money center banks.
If we're expecting yields to come down later this year and we're expecting the yield curve to get to a more normal level, money center banks probably are the better play, but not in the immediate term because there hasn't been a lot of movement. And to Guy's point, there's risks out there for yields to actually go higher, I think, in the near to medium term. So if and when you get the opportunity, I think money center banks are probably the better long-term opportunity. Investment banks, here's my question about investment banks. This is a question I ask myself. If we are at a point in the market or in the cycle where we think that exuberance is present, then aren't the investment banks at risk of that? Aren't they falling victim to that in an IPO process or in a process where companies are just looking at it and saying, we're worth an inflated valuation because everything else is trading at an inflated valuation? And then they get into deals where they're overly exposed. So I don't know that if we really want to be consistent with that thought process, I feel like investment banks are at risk of falling victim to
it. I think you're 100% right to talk about consistency. I think, yes, you're right. And I think for the duration you're talking about, it's going to play out, and that's a little longer term. For this shorter term thing, trying to incorporate earnings, what Dan is trying to do, I think, makes sense as well. So I think you both can be right. You put out a tweet, by the way. I love when things, not that I'm a big decoupling person, but things start to get interesting. And this chart that you put out on the Twitter, that, by the way, that's at Liz Young Strat, if you want to throw this up. I mean, you talk about these things have been in lockstep, these things being energy stocks and obviously the underlying commodity in the form of crude oil. And they've decoupled recently with the stocks actually sort of taking the lead. So one of two things is going to happen here. Either crude oil is going to catch up, which that's what I think is going to happen, or the energy stocks have gotten ahead of themselves. You put this out for a reason, EY.
Yeah, because I talk about relationships a lot. And when
do we have a good relationship? When
I think we do.
What do you mean you think we do?
I believe that we do have a good relationship.
That wasn't like a ring endorsement.
No, it was not at all.
It was, I mean, I'm guys. Maybe that's, are we being a little pick me right here?
Yeah, come on.
You have no idea.
I love you guys. I spend so much time. I spend more time with the two of you than anybody else in my profession.
Is that troubling you?
No, it's not troubling me.
But anyway, sorry.
I'm voting with my feet.
You brought up relationships.
So, but sometimes people have relationship problems.
Yes.
And there are some relationship problems going on in the market. I do like to highlight them, not to send a warning signal, but just to say, hey, this is out of whack. This isn't usually how this relationship works. So you can see here, this is one that has gotten out of whack. And again, the question is, which line is going to move? I do agree. I think that there's probably more likelihood for oil to spike up than there is for these stocks to come down because that rotation trade is well underway. And because energy had such a bad 2023, I think that's where money is searching for. Also, you get a good dividend in some of those stocks, which if that factor continues to be a driver, I think energy stocks continue to catch a bid. So we probably do see oil rise in this chart and see those lines come back together. The warning sign that I know I talk about all the time, if you see oil spike because of some kind of shock or because of some other reason, spikes in oil are not good things, especially at a time when we might be fragile for some kind of cooling off in the economy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm glad because, again, to talk about it is one thing, to see it as something entirely different. So I'm glad you brought that. And also say this, you're right to point that out. You could actually see crude oil catch up and the energy stocks go nowhere, maybe even a little bit lower. So the resolution of this, I believe, will take place with crude oil rallying, but not necessarily the underlying stocks keeping pace because they've already outpaced. It's the time in the show where we solicit and get questions. So my first one's going to be from a fellow Paisan, Lawrence Giordano, who wants to do something in French. He says, por favor. Oh, is that Spanish?
Espanol.
Yeah.
Yeah, French or Spanish. I don't speak either. I have trouble with English. Comment on gold. Well, I don't know if he means the miner gold, that would be American Barrick, or the commodity, but we can pull up both. For the first time in a while, Lawrence, and I know you know this, the miners are starting to actually get on their collective horses. So you look at it here. This, I believe, is a commodity. The commodity is clearly holding in there. But if you put some of these mining stocks up, Newmont's getting off the mat. American Barrick, in the form of GOLD, getting off the mat. Agnico Eagle Mines, which is the M in my clam, Dan.
Yep.
No comments necessary, getting off the mat. So I think we've reached the stage where the equity community is saying, you know what, gold, you've basically proved yourself. We're going to start buying the mining stocks. That's just me.
Well, good on you, because I remember asking you a question last week. If you own the commodity.
Good on you.
Good on you. I think that's British.
That's like a British thing.
British,
yeah. Good on you.
For good job.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I asked you last week, is this a time where you rotate out of the commodity and into the miners to catch the catch-up trade?
Yeah. And
so far, it looks like
that's what's happening.
Right.
So Lawrence is on top of things, Dan.
Yeah.
I have another question if you want.
Let's do it.
Is from Eric Palacios.
Okay.
Hopefully I said the name right. Yep. Are you as bullish on IWM as Tom Lee is? Well, it's hard for me to answer that, not knowing how bullish he is, but assuming he's very bullish.
Excuse me?
He made a call for 50% upside in
5-0.
5-0. I believe. And I think that was and Eric, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think that was a couple weeks ago. He made a call on CNBC for 50%.
That's aggressive. So in the form of the IWM, I can do that math. If it's 200, I'm rounding down. 50% would be 100. So he thinks it's going to 300. Okay. I guess anything's possible. I don't know if I'm that bullish, but I do think this is an environment where I think people will start saying, okay, what hasn't worked and what can I start to look at that may work? And that's coming in the form of the IWM, Dan.
Yeah. So, you know, to get back to those late 2021 highs, you got to get back to, where is it? 240 something, or here we are at 208.
Right.
You can do that math right there. So you need like a 12, 13% rally to get up there and then to keep going. Then you're going to need an epic breakout. Mm. There's going to have to be the sort of activity in the economy here. Okay. So largely focused here, right, Liz? What are some of the other conditions, right? So we're going to have to, the Fed just pulled back. In December, they were calling for 1.4% GDP growth here in the U.S. in 2024. Now it's above 2% or something like that. Mm-hmm. It would be the catch-up trade of all catch-up trades, right? Yes. There have to be a lot of things going really well to have this thing up 30, 40%.
Yeah, well, I think through 2024, I suppose it's possible because the real headwind on small caps is rates. The corporate maturity wall, which will hit small caps harder because they can't internally finance yet, doesn't really become a problem until 2025, 2026. We've been able to keep pushing it out. Companies have been able to just sort of make it through that. So I think that's really where the rubber hits the road if rates have not fallen. If we do see rates rise again, if something happens in the 10-year and you start to feel like either inflation is more entrenched or rates go up because of something that has nothing to do with inflation and perhaps has something more to do with the Japanese yen or something of that nature, that's where small caps start to get hit and we won't be able to see them get out of a certain range again.
Okay, cool. Guy, I have one from you. Oh. I'm sure we have a lot of great ones.
It's like Christmas.
Everybody opens
a different present.
Yeah, like, I want to go back to that energy because it's interesting. Because XLE, we know that it's Exxon, Chevron,
ConocoPhillips.
Let's pull up a 5-year log chart of the XLE. This is a really interesting chart right here. Okay. And again, look at that. That's a really nice consolidation, right? And so
what's that woman's name that I like?
Louise Yamada.
Louise Yamada.
Yeah.
The longer in the space, the higher in outer space or something.
Longer
right?
the base, higher in space.
So you see that. That's
now let's pull it out to 20-year log. And this is kind of interesting to me. So this is, this is smoothing for time.
Oh.
So you also get So I guess, you had all this M&A, you had all this, so either is that the mother of all head and shoulders?
That's what
right
you're saying.
There?
You're saying it's an exhaustion here.
Or is the consolidation that we've seen with these multiple highs in and around these levels? Let's go back to the other one. Let's toggle, as our main man Carter would say. Wow. It's interesting. I mean, like you would need some really positive.
All right. So let's play. I'll play your reindeer game with you for a second.
Go ahead.
So if let's just say, for example, you're long the XLE and you don't know what the outcome. You said, I know Louise Yamada, longer in space, the higher in outer space, or something.
Longer
like
the base,
that.
Higher in space.
Yeah, some whatever. So isn't that what I said?
Yeah.
And then you can say, I know what Dan Nathan is looking at too. I see both sides of that. So maybe the thing to do is the following: get out, take your profits. And then you say, well, why would you do that? If you think I do think it's going higher, but you can say, you know what? I'd rather get out here and then buy the potential breakout like you're doing in Morgan Stanley through, I believe, 98, which was the high back, I want to say 2014. So the thing to do here is, you know what? Pull the ripcord, buy the breakout above 98, or you say, you know what? Man, I caught this cold. Dan was right about those double tops, and you look to buy it cheaper. That's sort of trading 101 mechanics type of shit. Or you could sort of sit here and be paralyzed and do nothing. I'd rather move my feet, something Elizabeth said 17 minutes ago, than to be paralyzed here.
Pull up a 1 year that's not logged, so a normal chart. So look at this. I mean, that thing has had a heck of a run in a short period of time. It's one of the reasons why we like to look at some. All right, so look at that. So, guy, the mother of all doubles, as you'd say.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that you could think about, again, if those three stocks are incorporating what percent of the 30, 40%, or is it?
I think more than that, but I think it's almost 50. I think three stocks are almost maybe 44%.
Here's one for you guys. So the ETF is trading at $93. Okay. The 93 May call is 265. The June 93 call is 370 or something like that. So if you were long and you were saying, I caught this move from the low 80s to the low 90s, you could look to do a little
covered,
stock replacement.
Little covered call.
So let's say we're going to keep an eye. Well, you could also long and you could sell some calls.
Bring my tweet back up. Banerjee tweet. I just want to show people.
I love this.
There were these little red X's on that chart as well. And those little red X's are when energy stocks have entered overbought conditions.
So X marks the spot.
X marks the spot with a dot, dot, dot. Isn't that how the saying goes? But I don't know what that means.
I don't know.
Anyway, the red X's are telling you that energy stocks have entered an overbought condition, mm-hmm. according to the 14-day RSI. So in the near term, technically, they would be due for some type of a correction. But I wouldn't see that as a long-term correction that's going to persist, but in the near term,
my takeaway from this whole conversation, you saying overbought, we've seen this bifurcation, you see that maybe we're going to have some sort of like kind of reversion. And Guy Adami, after kind of pounding the table for the last couple of months on energy stocks, you're kind of saying, you know what,
I can move your feet because otherwise people blow by you like you're standing still. Elizabeth played point guard, she knows. Like, if you stand there, you're going to get smoked like a whiteout. You got to move your
feet all the time.
And you say it all the time. Yeah. Move your friggin' feet. Because you know what happens if you don't? You start to reach. You don't want to be reaching ever. You want to be moving. You want to move your feet. We have a question about Robinhood, I believe. So why don't you pull this question up? Because this is actually one we have gotten correct. I think at one point today, Robinhood was north of 20. We started talking about their talked about their balance sheet, their cash on hand and stuff. And I thought there's a real good chance that this year you would see this stock move in a meaningful way. Well, I guess 100% is a meaningful way because that's what we're seeing now. What do I think here? Well, look, there's a very good chance that it exhausts itself in the short term. You had that announcement today. They're getting into some sort of credit card-y type of thing. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I like to stick to your knitting, but Vlad Tenev, who cut his hair, by the way, made a pretty compelling case. I think, you know what? I'm inclined to sort of take some money off the table, look for a pullback, or you could ride the horse. What do you think here, Dan?
Yeah, Liz, you're not going to have much to say in this. I mean, I think they want to probably look a little bit more. Yeah.
But what happened today was they announced a credit card and you get cash back that you can use to invest with. So I think if nothing else, this is an indication that people like the idea of getting money to put into the stock market, which I think is an indication of risk appetite.
SoFi is up today, by the way, as well.
Let's be very clear, and this is my take, not Liz's. I mean, they're taking a page out of the SoFi playbook. This is a company I've watched yours for a long time now, since before it was public, and I've seen the way that your customers, your members, have evolved right through the financial system. You guys didn't start with investing products. You know what I mean? To me, this makes perfect sense. And the other thing I'll just say is that, you know, a lot of that move in the last, you know, few months or so has to do with crypto. Just overlay it with Bitcoin, overlay it with Coinbase, you know what I mean? Like, that's what's going on here. But I guess one of the reasons, Guy, when you and I were looking at this thing, you know, like a handful of months ago, was that, listen, when you looked at that balance sheet, how much net cash they had relative to their market cap and where, you know, like their kind of opportunity set was kind of lining up, it looked like a really cheap way to play for a reemergence in risk assets in general. And again, that brand, believe it or not, is still fine, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm going to ask, Jay's got a question here. Okay. This is out of nowhere, but I like type of stuff like this. Natural resources are widely ignored by many portfolios. Fair. Thoughts on PHO, which is a bit of an eclectic ETF towards companies involved with water. So PHO, which I'm actually quasi familiar with, it's been lower left to upper right. I think the largest holding in the PHO is a company called Ferguson PLC, but I'm going to go back in fast money history and point out that I think Danaher, which comes out DHR, is the second or third largest holding. And so we can put up a Danaher chart and you'll look at this. They're going to look eerily familiar or similar, I should say. Danaher, Dan, as you may or may not know, was founded by two brothers, Mitchell and Stephen Rales, two people you've probably never heard of because they don't want you to know who they are. How did they come up with the name Danaher? Elizabeth's asked me. That's a great question. They were on a trip out in Montana, I believe, or Idaho, but they were on a tributary of, I believe, the Colorado River, which was called Danaher. And they're like, that would be a great name for a company. This is one of the great sort of M&A companies that nobody talks about. So to answer your question, yes, I like this, Jay. You can play it with the ETF, or you can be stock specific and stay long Danaher. That was a great job by me.
Amazing. Danaher is a $183 billion market cap company that I probably have not ushered the word of in a decade.
It's pretty. That's the history of Danaher there. The Rails
brothers.
How did
you know that?
Mitchell and Stephen Rails, because one of the first companies we talked about on CNBC's Fast Money in 2006, by the way, it was a show that was just a segment, was Danaher. And I did a little research. I'm like, that's really cool. These two brothers out there on the river fishing and shit. They came up with the idea for a company. They're on this tributary. And like, we should name the company Danaher.
Now last you're looking year, this shit earnings up, I know. Were down 30%. Sales were down 24%. Expected to be flat this year.
Danaher River in Montana.
This is off the rails a little bit. Yeah. But like, what hurts the water trade? So if you've got, I'm looking at the ETF FO, literally lower left to upper right. If we did an RSI on this, I'm willing to bet it looks overbought. What kills the water trade?
That's a question that, you know, every good attorney has an answer for a question. In this case, I do not have one.
Well, it's interesting. And one of my favorite Daniel Craig Bond movies was Quantum of Solace. And if you remember,
did they do a water thing?
There was a whole water thing. The whole plot was about this Bond villain who is trying to get access to this like wasteland in Chile, because underneath it was like lots of water. And that was the whole thing. Yeah.
Water's important.
I miss Daniel Craig as Bond. Like he was,
he was the best one. Well, I think Sean Connery, looked like obviously. Bond. He looked, you know, physique wise, you'd be like that cat's James
Remington
Bond.
Steele was a favorite Bond of mine. You know who I'm
Pierce
talking about.
Brosnan.
I loved him. I thought he was good too.
You know what kind of suit James Bond wears?
Double breasted.
No,
Tom Ford.
What brand? Yeah, there you go.
I know.
Look at you.
Good job.
But he's not going to be Bond anymore. I think he's sort of done.
Should we bust it? Should we do this?
What?
Should we get out of here?
Nobody had Danaher on their friggin' bingo card.
No.
Fact that it's, by the way, apparently it's not a river, it's a creek.
Oh.
Yeah, I like
not
a good
babbling
creek.
Brook, though?
Excuse me?
A babbling brook.
Brooks are nice, too.
Yeah.
What do you think the difference between a creek and a brook is? I'm not sure there is
a
one.
Brook babbles.
It's the difference between sort of a panther and a puma. Or mountain lion. Yeah. They're all very... By the way, I saw some cat got killed, not a cat, actually a human being, by a mountain lion. And theoretically, I should feel... You know, if you're out there in their territory, like if you're messing with grizzly bears and shit...
No, but that's the point. A lot of these animals are coming into our...
Hold on a second. No. Yeah. They were here long before we were. Okay? You know, you want to build houses and shit, that's what happens. So we're infiltrating their territory.
Yeah, you have bears in your backyard in New Jersey.
I love the bears.
Or they ate one of your dogs, like Flip.
Well, they're not going to eat Flip. Flip's a big guy. They might eat Russell. But hey, I mean, that's Darwinism.
You would be
look that shit up.
You would be wrecked if Russell got torn apart by a bear.
Listen, they go outside. The hawks could get him. The eagles could get him. That, you know, you're in their world.
It's true.
Nobody. Okay.
Like when Americans go to foreign countries and get mad that they don't speak English.
Exact same type of thing. Yeah. There's a hubris associated with that. No. Okay. It's like I'll give you it before we get out of here. It's like some asshole goes to the zoo.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're hanging their kid over the side of the polar bear exhibit or something. And the kid falls in. And
not
the polar
kid's fault.
Is it the bear's fault? But they subsequently should euthanize, not the bear, the effing parents who are hanging the kid over the side.
Or neuter him.
Huh? Why would you neuter the bear?
The parents. The parents. So
well,
they
it's
can't
too late for that.
Yeah, too late for that.
All right.
Okay. Sorry. That note, that's it. I had fun.
That was fun.
Elizabeth is like, my God. She had fun. We're back tomorrow. Tomorrow's Thursday.
Yeah. What do we got?
Apparently this upsets people or some people.
Okay. We have John Butters. We have the senior earnings insight analyst from FactSet.
Doesn't upset
we
people.
We have his work on
there.
Yeah, it's kind of like how we kind of refer to him. It was the Britney thing, but it's fine. We're moving on. John Butters is the man. You've made him into something that he could have only hoped and dreamed to become in the financial services business. So
is Carter Worth with us tomorrow?
Carter
too?
Braxton Worth. Who, you've done a number for him also too. CBW, I think you coined that.
And what else did I coin? EY from SoFi.
I don't have a nickname, but it's fine. We'll work on that. We've been together for 15 years.
You don't need a nickname. Yeah. But Elizabeth goes, like, if she were to go to a Knick game tonight, I don't even know if they're playing, but people would say, oh my God, that's EY. Now, they might not say it to your face, But I guarantee they're mumbling that shit. They're looking at their buddy.
My mom says that.
She calls you EY from SoFi?
She texted me today and said, are you going to change your name when you get married? How are you going to be E.T.?
No, you're not E.T. You will be EY from SoFi.
You will always be EY.
I'm looking forward to meeting your mom. Is she looking forward to meeting us? Don't lie.
Oh, yeah.
Is she really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Does she drink scotch or is she a teetotaler?
She does like old fashions occasionally, but she can probably only handle one of those. So, we'll let her take it slow.
We'll be the judge of that. I mean, when we meet her, but we'll see. All right. That's it.
I had fun.
That was fun. Thanks,
we'll be back tomorrow. See you later, everybody.
Thank you.